Hello, everybody, and welcome back to an episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. I am your singular host today, Crystal Williams. My pronouns are she, her. And I'm just here alone, just talking to myself, trying to keep the demons at bay. There's a demon in the corner who keeps yelling satanic ritual messages to me, which is weird because I'm cool with the Church of Satan and it thinks it's scaring me, but like, I'm trans, so it does nothing to me. So
quiet, that sounds like a demon. Personal problem, honestly.
Ah, who are you?
I mean, you invited me here. I was just kind of being quiet for dramatic effect this whole time.
Oh, but right. Like, yeah, that's just me being driven insane. We do have a guest today.
Did you forget I was here this whole time? We were just talking for the last 20 minutes before we started this recording.
You know that the demon does things to my brain?
You know, that's a person. That sounds like a problem. Also, I mean, are you sure it's a demon? It probably is, actually, when we're talking about it. I probably put it there. Who knows?
It's whatever the entity is from the movie Skinamarink.
Yeah, that might be worse than a demon, honestly. You might be in trouble there, if that's the case.
Why are there no doors?
Well, you're stuck with me now, so I guess I can just introduce myself then.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome back to the show. You want to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Anthony. My pronouns are he, him. I am a writer and regular annoyance on this show. Thank you for having me again, Crystal. I'm really happy to be here.
I am very happy to be here. Last time we had you on was for our big 100th episode, which was actually a lot of fun.
It was so much fun.
I think it was a great episode. It was probably one of the best we've done. And yes, as you heard, it's just going to be the two of us today. The other hosts are kind of currently engaging in a epic quest of fighting aliens from another dimension who want to take over the world. So hopefully they're going to be successful in their quest, and then we'll come back with the heads of these aliens that we can put in spikes around our individual houses. So,
I thought they were touching grass.
Well, the bodies of those aliens are now touching grass.
So. Oh, well, so you have to pick them up off the ground. I see.
Yeah, and weirdly enough that, like, those aliens only fight with swords, so it's a lot of just old-fashioned sword fighting.
That's the best kind of fighting, though. We need more stories where people pick up giant swords and slash, like, monstrous metal things in the air. Speaking of which, Metal Gear Solid Revengeance.
Oh, wow. What a segue.
I'm very tempted with that.
We discovered that we're both really into the Metal Gear franchise, famously created by the legendary Hideo Kojima. And I brought up in the last podcast to me talking to a silent room of people who've never played any of the games and going like, but they're amazing and they have like all these like, they predicted the future and some of them are so over the top, but some of them are like really like geopolitically still relevant.
I'm just disappointed none of them had ever played a Metal Gear Solid game. Those games are great. I remember playing them when I was a kid back on the original for the PlayStation. The original is Metal Gear for the NES, but like I'm talking like the original Metal Gear Solid for the PS1. That was just a formative experience.
You know, it's funny as I never had a PS1, so I never played it back in the day. I think the first time I ever played a Metal Gear Solid game was PS3 because it was on the PlayStation Store.
Ooh, yeah, no. I've been playing this since PlayStation 1 era. Actually, to be fair, though, it wasn't the game I was. What's funny about Metal Gear Solid 1 was, even though I feel like the series has defined my tastes in video games, at the time, while I loved Metal Gear Solid, the game that like struck me the most with PlayStation 1 would have had to have been Final Fantasy VII, which is a whole other discussion, which I can get into, but no one wants me to for some reason.
And I would, but I it would go over my head. I would just go like, there's things and there's a fantasy, and is it final?
Well, considering we're on 16, I don't think so.
And then there's a lady who is killed in that game. I know that.
Why do you have to bring that up, Crystal? Why did you have to do that to me, Crystal? It's too soon. It's 25 years too soon.
I used to watch G4, and on G4 they constantly talk about that ending of the game. So that's like
really
the only thing. That's the only thing I know about the game because that's the only thing they would bring up.
But there's so much other good things about Final Fantasy VII, like the whole plot.
The cross-dressing.
Well, that also was actually a really good moment, actually. There's also a scene where a bunch of men in a gym try to... Okay, I'm not going to get to that, though.
I will say, I need to go back because I did play some of the remake because
I never played it too.
And I didn't make it that far into it because it was, like, I don't know why. To me, it was, like, really hard, and I was just getting really frustrated, and I just quit.
Yeah, no, the remake is actually, I think, really good. I legitimately really enjoy the remake of Final Fantasy VII. I love how they make how they really humanize Aerith and Tifa in a way that reminds you of the good character writing for the original game, because, you know, a lot of the fandom over time with Aerith and Tifa really kind of boiled them down to their basic characteristics. And you forget that, you know, Aerith isn't just some pure soul who is, you know, indescribably beautiful and, you know, pure of heart. She's a really sassy, sarcastic character, and I love that. Like, she's so witty in the original game, and they really play that up in the remake in some really good bits. To say nothing of the scene where she beats someone over the head with a chair, even, like, just small bits where she just swears under her breath in such an innocently cute way, but also, like, clearly she is someone who grew up on the streets, even though she is a titanically powerful entity. And it's a whole, that's beside the point.
So that is an entirely different can of Japanese storytelling worms to open.
Oh yeah,
it's like we can make this a Final Fantasy, a Kingdom Hearts, and a Metal Gear episode in one episode. But I mean, like, can we though? Like,
trust me, I'm gonna be bouncing from topic to topic. I'm currently drinking a cocktail of Blue Moon and Blue Curacao. My brain's not gonna be focused on any one topic for very long. So
Let's hop right back on that train track, so right back to the series that I have played, and that is the Metal Gear Solid franchise.
Exactly.
And I played it for the first time, really, in its entirety, a few years ago, 2018, and I did a little project with it. Now, I don't want to share said little project because it's under my dead name, but... I will say that I would play each game, take about a month to complete each one, and then, like, write something very long about it. I'll send it to you later so you can read it. There's quite
I'd
a lot
to take
of,
a look at it.
Yeah, there's quite a lot I've written about the series. Some of it, my articles reached past 3,000 to 4,000 words, which is quite a lot for the site I was writing for. So I had a lot to say.
Oh, yeah, I believe that. I played, I actually have not played, I mentioned this to you in its entirety, I've not finished Final Fantasy, Metal Gear Solid 5. The beginning, I don't know what it was, I think after 4 was such a final ending to it, I didn't want to play any other games. Like, it kind of felt like that was the end for me, and I was like, okay, I've gone on this journey, I can't go back on right now.
That's fair.
Except for Revengeance.
Which
is a beautiful, batshit insane cluster of art, and I just love how bizarrely gonzo it is.
Oh, do you like the scene where Raiden's disguised when he goes to Mexico?
Everything. I like freaking Markiplier with his sword showing up. That senator. I like the dogs. I like chopping things up. I like the scenes where he just cuts things up really, really good and just keeps cutting them. And then just runs up something while cutting it on trains, going through labs, going through basically... it's so ridiculous. I don't think anyone understands the plot of that game fully because no one really cares. It's just crazy, insane things happening one after the other.
So, but for unlike, people not aware, for Revengeance, it is a spin-off Metal Gear Solid game from the main series that is not helmed by creator Hideo Kojima. But I'm not. Maybe you know more than I do. Did he have like some inputs on it?
I think he had minimal input. I'm not an expert on the behind-the-scenes development of any of the games, so don't take my words with a grain of salt. But I'm pretty sure he kind of gave them like the go-ahead. And he'd poke his head in occasionally and say, oh, hey, how's things going in here? All right, the building hasn't burned down yet. Keep doing whatever you're doing. And that's probably about it. I think it was an entirely separate crew from Kojima's crew, but I'm not positive. Don't hold me to it. I could be wrong. In fact, I probably am.
But you're probably close.
That sounds like how it would go.
That so makes sense.
So I'm pretty sure at the time he was still working on
Five, right?
On Five, yeah. I think this is when Five was going on. Or, like, he was kind of coerced into doing Five. I don't think he wanted to do Five at first. Because...
Well, Four is a finale in terms of the main story.
It's very definitive ending in terms of everything. The fact they're making another Metal Gear Solid game without Kojima's involvement has me a little worried. Because Konami...
So I wanted to bring up some news, and we brought it up last time, but they are remaking Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater, mm-hmm. which is the third game, which is my favorite game in the entire franchise.
I think it's everyone's favorite game in the franchise. I don't think anyone would argue with you on that one.
No, I think each game is at least 9 out of 10, in my my opinion. I think it's... I think Metal Gear Solid 3 is a game that I rarely give out, but I still consider that a perfect 10.
Yeah, agreed.
I think it's a really good mix of Kojima's wacky tendencies, a really interesting setting, like really compelling characters. Like I'd say in a lot of ways, Big Boss is more compelling than Snake, or Solid Snake. But they're both.
I would say that was fair.
Not to take away from Solid Snake, who's a legendary character, but I would say Big Boss is definitely a bit more. There's a lot more emotional heft to him.
I feel Solid Snake gets most emotional in like Four. I feel
Four.
Like. He's at the end of his life.
Right. I think that's probably why I resonate, or I think that character is more compelling. But it's not that I think either one are like. You know, there's no, if you're a Metal Gear fan and you like Solid Snake more, that's completely fine to you. But, you know.
Yeah, it's a real tragedy to Naked Snake. I agree. He's,
yeah,
especially because he's this idealist at the beginning of the game and you realize that he's playing, like a lot of the metatextual, idea of Metal Gear often is that the characters are playing a game, essentially. They're playing a role in a greater story. Where the controls lies just outside of their reach, with the Patriots, with the boss's agenda in, you know, Metal Gear Solid 3. And, you know, and again, even with 4, it's a combination of agendas. It's really, I mean, 2, I think, is the most meta of all of them, because it is just
It's
so
funny how that game at the time got so much hate. But I actually think it's better than the original in its boldness.
Oh yeah. And the funny thing is, it just did what the other games were already doing, just more overtly.
Yeah.
You know, all the games are about these scenarios set up by the antagonists that the heroes essentially follow through on. And all their choices are parts of this orchestrated maneuver for some greater sense of control or power or to just demonstrate that they have power. Like, 2 is interesting because it's like the whole point of the game is to demonstrate that the Patriots have power. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Kind of. Depending on how you read Ocelot's role in the story. Ocelot in 3, I think, is very interesting. Because you see the foundations of this character who you've gotten to know, but you really get to know here. Even though, because Ocelot's such a cool dude, you know, he's such a cool antagonist in 1 and 2, but I don't think people really understood the sheer scope of Ocelot's character writing until the end of 4.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil how that ends, but there is a big twist involving his character that really illustrates just how fast, what 4D chess this guy's playing in the entire game franchise.
Yeah.
If you've played it, you know what I'm talking about. Hypnosis is involved. I won't specify how. It's just so brilliant and so clever. But with 3, you see the grounding of that character. And it's such a smooth character arc, especially with 3 as the... you know what I'm trying to get at. I love everything about this series.
Same.
Except for the post-Kojima games.
Yeah, that's fair. But... I will say, 5, when you get to, like, the last couple hours of the game, like, you can see Kojima's hands all over it, and it's phenomenal.
I believe, like, that fully. I just couldn't, yeah. I just couldn't play it. I couldn't bring myself to it after 4 had such a perfect ending. I've had that happen a few times, though, with some games, where it's like, there's such a great end point, and I just can't get back on after that.
Yeah, even if I think it's great. I don't even think if you want to skip playing it, you can at least look up, like the story stuff.
That's
like,
true.
It's at least worthwhile for that, you know? Because it just adds more context and layers to an already amazing series.
Agreed.
At least for, like, a completionist sake, because that does add a lot of interesting stuff to it.
That's fair. And
so, yeah, I would say two to me in terms of, like, the sort of geopolitical convoluted, like, the not convoluted, but, like, complicated, thoughtful political storytelling is probably Kojima's best in terms of that, while 3 is my overall favorite of the entire series. You know,
what do you think about Raiden, though? Or Raiden? Raiden?
Like, what, that it switches to him in 2?
Yeah, like, as a character. Like, how do you think they took his character? Because I feel like I initially didn't like how they turned him into a metal cyborg in 4, but, like, it really grew on me once I played 4. Like, when the trailers for the game and all the previews were coming out and they were saying, oh, he's a cyborg now, I'm like, really? I don't know how I feel about that. But when I played it, it was like, no, I get it now. This is perfect.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think Raiden is a really interesting character. I think the fact that people were so hesitant to it when it came out is really interesting, because that game is so clearly using a new character and a new perspective to deliver the real story and the real message that Kojima was trying to get across. Mm. Like
he's a child soldier, essentially. Like, he's just a pawn of Solid Snake. Yeah, he's a pawn of a greater evil. And the fact that Solidus Snake is another clone of Naked Snake, and he's doing the exact same thing to, you know, Raiden that essentially the big boss did to Solid Snake and Solidus and Liquid by extension, it's this weird cycle of perpetuating violence and abuse, and it's tragic. It's genuinely tragic, but I feel like what a lot of people at the time could not get over was that Raiden was a pretty boy.
I also felt like that had to do with, like, some, like, I don't know, internalized homophobia.
Oh, like, definitely.
Yeah.
And let's be fair. Metal Gear Solid was one of the most bisexual games I've ever played. Just, there's so much.
MGS2 has a bisexual vampire. So.
Exactly. But even ignoring the bisexual vampire, you have that scene in 3 where, was it Vulcan? Was that the guy's name?
Yeah.
Figures out that, you know, Naked Snake is in disguise by, you know, getting a good old reach around and going,
yeah,
yeah, that's not you. I can tell. You're an imposter. Like, how many times have you done that? How many times you check that out? Wanna share someone with class there?
Yeah, but Anne, I thought that the West invented LGBT stuff last week.
Don't get me started on that again. Don't get me starting that stupid post. Do you know when people were so upset that I said that, you know, the Japan. The very factual statement that Japan has a history with theatrical performances involving people dressing as the opposite gender. And Japan didn't, I mean, is Kabuki drag? That's up for your opinion. I think it's in the grander category of, for the context for those who don't know what we're talking about, last week I responded to a post from a rather well-known alt-right user. That argued that because Japan has been doing drag shows, that the West is somehow corrupting their pure Eastern culture by introducing the LGBTQ agenda. And I pointed out, hey, this isn't the first time Japan has done drag. You know, drag's been a part of Japan for a while. there's been tons of stories about cross-dressing in Japanese culture.
Yep.
Or even Oda Nobunaga is said to have cross-dressed at least once or twice.
And we're not talking like just like 100 years. We're talking centuries. We're talking
Nobunaga was there in the 1600s. And even if you want to talk about recently, you know, Japan has had all women performances in their in some of their theatrical productions, one of which was a James Bond adaptation, an all women's performance of James Bond.
I actually didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Oh yeah, it is pretty cool. I forget the name of the theater, but it's like an all women troupe, and they did a performance based on the James Bond character. So technically, they're the first female James Bond in media, period. And you can probably watch like recordings of it, probably.
That's really interesting.
Actually, I'm not sure if it's out yet. I know it was being performed. I'm not sure it's been performed for the public yet, though. It probably has, because I read this a few months ago. So it's probably old hat by now. But, yeah, no, it's a thing.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you count Kabuki as drag. I don't know if I would. But I would say that it's definitely in the greater umbrella of that kind of performance. And several drag queens have cited Kabuki as an inspiration for their particular craft. What comes to mind specifically are some of the drag queens on the show, the Boulay Brothers Dragula, which is on Shudder, and you should watch it because it's really quite good.
Yeah, I heard it's good.
Oh yeah, it's quite fun. And I like how they do drag that's also horrific and grotesque and ugly.
Well, horror,
which is great,
right?
Which is great. I love it. Like, they'll just be like some of the most foul, disgusting things you can imagine that they just put in their costumes, but they also make it a performance, and it's very effective, and it's great. I enjoy it quite a lot. Anyway, so some of the drag queens in that directly cited Kabuki as a direct inspiration for their costumes. So some drag queens do understand that that Kabuki exists in the history of their art, you know, maybe not like a direct influence, but it's in that under the umbrella, so to speak, just like Shakespearean performances where women weren't allowed to perform are in that grander umbrella. It's not, you know, you can't say it's a one-to-one link, but it is
a link.
It is a link of some kind, a route, not the route. But some people are trying to argue like, you know, Kabuki isn't drag. It's not like, and it would pull all these excuses as to why it couldn't be drag. And for fun, I was telling them all, yeah, but I think you're wrong. just to rustle some feathers after a while. And also to prove a point, you know, that people have this knee-jerk reaction to drag. They really don't, most people don't understand what it even is. Like, who get angry about it?
I mean, playing with gender expression is as old as, like, time itself. Like, as long as humans have existed, that's kind of been a thing. So, like,
even in their, like, super macho folklore, there is drag. You know, like, the example I always think of is Thor dressing up as a bride.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, you look in, like, the mythology. Even this is really interesting, too. And I didn't know this until fairly recently. In ancient Egypt, the gods were sometimes written in the opposite gender in texts. The god, so like Isis, Osiris, Horus, Anubis, all of them had male and female components.
Hmm.
So, and that's something to do with the Egyptian language. And it's something we don't totally understand because obviously Egypt is such an older society. That's not to say that the Egyptian gods were gender fluid or anything like that. It's to say that they had male and female aspects. Or kind of like an animus and anima, if we want to use, you know, Jungian psychology, male aspects within the female and female aspects within the male. I don't know if you can count it as true gender queerness or non-binary elements because they're not really human. But it is interesting to discuss that the perspectives of gender that we have now were not really as standardized as certain people would like you to believe.
No.
That there were periods in history where gender was directly questioned. Even more so than currently.
Probably like way more so than currently.
Oh yeah. Like it's fascinating from a historical perspective. And again, I'm not an expert. I'm just echoing what I've read. You know, I'm just saying what people have, what I've read from the experts. So if there's a better source than what I'm saying, by all means presented, I would love to see this. I would love to be, to learn more about this topic. I find it very interesting.
Yeah, same.
And again, I'm also saying this after consuming a cocktail of Blue Moon and Blue Curacao, so my judgment on all things is questionable at best.
That's just me 24/7.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Like I half the time I'm like, should I post this?
I just don't even question it. I just do it at this point, no matter how awful it might be. Like for example, I will add this moment of controversy to this discussion, going back to the Metal Gear Solid thing.
Yes, I wanted to come back around.
More upset that Kojima couldn't make Silent Hills than another Metal Gear Solid game.
That is an interesting perspective and a valid one.
Yeah, because for me, Metal Gear Solid's done. Like for me, you can remaster the old games, reboot them, but I feel like the story is complete, and I feel like it's unhappy with how it ended. Silent Hill can never go away. It's that kind of open-ended story where there is no ending point. It just keeps going.
Especially since, like, PT was so awesome.
It was incredible. And you got Kojima, and you got Guillermo del Toro, and you got Norman Reedus, all working on one project. That was not the project that we got eventually.
Totally. I mean, but they did work together.
They did, and I'm not a fan of Death Stranding all that much. I need to
go back to it, but I actually was really I liked it when I played it. I just realized I don't have time to play this game at this moment because I work so much. You know?
I like the world. I like the characters to an extent. I do not like the gameplay. It just bores me so much. Like the gameplay.
I mean, that's fair. Everyone has their own things. I actually found the gameplay kind of interestingly soothing and and engaging, just because I don't think I'd play the game ever like that. And I think it deserves some credit for that. But I understand the more mixed perspective to it. I just also realized that it was a game that I knew if I was going to play, I was going to spend an entire afternoon playing. You know, like, I'd have to spend 4 or 5 hours going through it. Like,
that's fair.
I don't think it's a game that I could... Most games that I choose nowadays are games I can pick up that I can play maybe 30 minutes to an hour at a time and feel like I leave it in a safe spot so that when I pick it back up, I can get a second to breathe before continuing to move forward with it, you know?
That's fair. I just... I don't know. I'm at that point where... If you're going to make a walking simulator, essentially, like, you got to – I mean, I do appreciate that the world is beautiful. They have this beautiful component to it. And I hear a lot of people who get sucked into the game. They just kind of get so sucked in that they lose track of themselves and you lose track of everything. You kind of become part of this bigger story. But, like, I don't know. I just had a hard time. I kept waiting for something to happen. And things happened, but they didn't happen – in a way that got me into the game. And I respect that it's not my, that's not everyone's experience. I just had a hard time with it.
No, that's fine. I think it deserves some sort of credit because.
Oh yeah, it deserves tons of credit. I'm not, mainly, don't get me wrong.
I'm not saying you're denying it. What I'm saying is like the fact that it had such an emotional response from people that varied is really interesting art. Like,
oh, yeah.
I think, like, with Neil Druckmann talking about The Last of Us, like, I know they weren't certain about the ending, but his response was, I don't care if people hate it. Like, I would fail as a game maker if I didn't make people at least feel something.
Yeah, and I prefer that. I prefer when an artist swings to the fences, even if it upsets everyone, because I just think it's more interesting that way. Art is better when it's unsafe. I'd rather
I think the ending of The Last of Us is brilliant, but yeah.
Yes, also I agree. It's actually very funny. I showed my parents the Last of Us series, and they have no context of what the game is. They actually had no idea there was a game until, like, I guess halfway through my mother was like, oh, you know, there's a video game based on this show. I'm like, no, actually, gotta strike that verse there for a second. But I remember when they got to the last episode, which is fairly close to the game, except a few, you know, gameplay differences. They were really upset. They did not like the ending at all. They were so upset by it. And I'm like, isn't that proof they're doing something right? Because it wasn't the same anger that you got with, like, The Sopranos, where they felt more frustrated, like they missed something. Or with Game of Thrones, where you could tell it was cheapening the story that came before it. It was almost like you felt betrayed to some extent, or hurt by it emotionally. And I think that's, like, proof the game and the show that adapted it is doing something very right.
I mean, that's the point, right? Exactly. I mean, I think people thought to... Which is really interesting. We can get into this mild discussion before we circle back to Metal Gear for like a second to finish that mm-hmm. up. But mm-hmm. I think I am a unabashed, huge, big fan and supporter of Last of Us 2. I think that game is, in my opinion, is masterful. And I think it works based on the ending of the first game, right?
Like, yeah.
It definitely is a continuation of the themes that is specifically brought into that, where Joel, who you could easily mistake, and a lot of games do this, making your protagonist the hero. Joel is not a hero.
He is
a person who is doing his best for survival, and he does awful, unspeakable things that you can't morally justify. Like, there's no way around getting what he does. So he is not the good guy. And I think to takes that perspective and forces you to look at it. Like, stare deeply into it, which is why I love it.
But for the most part, people love Joel. And that's what I find so interesting. Like, people don't dislike... With a lot of morally gray protagonists sometimes, you'll get frustration with how the character's behaving. But with Joel, you kind of get the sense that you really just like... You get his humanity, and you really appreciate that.
Which I think was what makes it more nuanced,
oh,
right?
Oh, 100%, like, yeah. But it's not like a game like where... But there's other games that exist out there where... And books and movies, of course. I won't keep it just to games. There's one example of a book I'm thinking of that I want to talk about later that I've been...
Okay, we'll bring it up.
...really obsessing with this whole last month. But, with games, for example, bringing it back to Konami, you got Silent Hill 2, with a character mm-hmm. James Sunderland.
You know what? That's a series I need to either play or watch somebody play through. I have not experienced it.
I forget the main character's last name of the second game, but I'll keep it without spoilers. But essentially, the game Silent Hill 2 is going into his psyche. You know, like mm-hmm. the monsters you find are manifestations of his own suppressed phobias and anger, and it's not subtle at all. There's no subtlety.
Well, subtlety is for cowards.
Exactly. Oh yeah, exactly. they're very upfront. It is like an ironic hell of sorts that James goes through, and you understand his humanity. But the more you understand, in many ways, you're actually repulsed by it. Like, you see the ugliest parts of his life, and it's just uncomfortable and unpleasant, and you don't want to be there. But with The Last of Us, what The Last of Us does so well is it makes you really like Joel, even though you see these unspeakable acts of violence. Because you just see the humor in the situation, you see the joy in the situation, you see his happiness. Whereas with James, you see nothing but his self-loathing and pain. And it is human, it is relatable, it is sympathetic at times. But you just see just enough of it where you're like, you just feel like you want to take a shower, genuinely. When you break down what everything means and what everything represents, it's like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this guy anymore.
is that why Silent Hill 2 is considered the best in the series as well?
Well, that and because it's scary. That's a key factor. Because a lot of the games do break the character's psyche down very well, but... It's also not all scary, like Silent Hill 2 is.
Good.
And I would say...
It should be scary.
Oh, sorry, I cut you off there. My earphones acted up there for a second.
Oh, I said, good, it should be scary.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Silent Hill 4 has some scary bits, though. and 3 and 1, but 2 is the one that nothing scares me more than just going through that one early in the game. You go through this apartment complex and everything is dark. And you know, everyone talks about the scene where Pyramid Head shows up and he does his thing, but the scene that I remember scared me so much as a teenager playing it was when you go into a room and you first encounter those mannequin legs where, like, the top half are legs, the bottom half are legs, and you just get up and you're, like, looking at this thing that's coming towards you, and you're like, what am I looking at? Like, you're scared already because it's been building to something jumping out at you. But when it does come out at you, it's, like, just legs, and you're like, what? What is this?
That reminds me of me playing Resident Evil Village recently for the first time and running into that fucking baby.
Oh, the baby. Oh, the best. Wow, what are you talking about? It's a great baby. Just a hungry, teething boy who just wants his nibbles, I guess. You know how babies are. They put everything in their mouth.
I was so...
In this case, entire human torsos.
I was like, nope.
I love that. It's so terrifying.
What's worse is that part where you have to run on into the bedroom and hide under the bed, and then you can just hear it shuffling and moving in.
Oh, it's so disgusting and terrifying.
I don't think I've ever been more scared playing a video game hiding under a bed than I did during that, because I had headphones on, and mm-hmm. you hear every sound.
Can you imagine that in VR?
Is there a VR version? I know
there's a VR of 7, but like I think there's a VR of 8 probably at this point, or someone's tried modding it so you could do that. I just know I wouldn't want to be in that experience.
I experienced that, and then I was like, I need to laugh, and so I pulled up YouTubers playing it. It's getting scared.
Oh, yeah, I lost. I especially love when you can see like the cutesy VTubers doing it, and they have like this, and they break character. Like, you haven't played like the little kid voices, and all of a sudden you hear like them go and totally break character and go, holy fuck! Like, I love that, because you just see like the genuine terror in their voice.
It's the scariest part of that game for sure. And then I played the Rose DLC.
Mm-hmm.
Did you play that?
No, I have not played DLC for 8 yet. I've heard it's good though.
There's a sequence that rivals that.
Oh my god.
Oh, did you hear about... Speaking of mannequins...
Mm-hmm.
Just be prepared for weeping angel mannequins.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about. Great. Fantastic. I can't wait. So excited.
They are horrifying.
Oh my god.
You literally have to walk backwards in darkness.
I love it. I love it. I hate it. I love it because I know this would scare people, and I would love to write something like that. But also, I don't want to experience it. But I also know I have to.
Well, you do and you don't. That's part exactly. of being a horror fan.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Oh, my goodness. Actually, it is strange being a horror fan and then, like, getting into something that's like more mainstream and like realizing that you're just, it doesn't affect you at all. And I will use an example of the book I've been obsessed with for the last couple months, and book series, I should say, and have been annoying my spouse about it on a regular basis. So there's a young adult fantasy series by Leigh Bardugo. It's the Grishaverse, essentially. It's a series of interconnected fantasy novels. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very interesting. I feel like some of the books are better than others. They made an adaptation on Netflix of decent quality, I'd say. But I was talking to some of my friends in real life about these books, and one of them pointed out, oh, I couldn't get into it. It was just too dark. And I'm like, what do you mean? There's nothing dark about it. And then they explain to me why they find it dark, and I'm like, oh, actually, I guess that's fair, I suppose. But none of that struck me as dark, because I'm so used to, like...
Oh, when you're a horror fan, you're used to, like, the darkest things imaginable.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. And this series has, like, say, they have monsters, they have this one duology of the books, Six of Crows, it starts with, All the main characters are basically criminals, and it's great. It's like Fantasy's Ocean's 11 as a YA book. And half the characters are either gay or bisexual.
Oh, well, that's an added benefit.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge benefit. Like, one of them's a criminal mastermind, one's an assassin, one's a witch, one's a gunslinger, one's a fighter, and then one's a twink.
That's their ability.
Yeah, one's a twink. That's basically.
Okay,
twink.
I got it.
He's a mechanical genius, whatever, mathematician. But he's a twink. that's what he is.
Okay.
And if that doesn't get you to read the books, then I don't know what can.
I don't know what will.
Yeah, it's great. It's a
lot
of fun.
I don't want to live in a world where someone doesn't want to read a book of a twink.
Yeah, it's great. And he's like, and they're all viewpoint characters. You get to see inside their heads. It's fantastic. It's great. And obviously I'm underselling just how interesting this book is. The characters are really cool and all, but like, you know, like you read a book like that and you think, oh yeah, it's a fun lighthearted read. I found it very light at times. And then someone pointed out, yeah, what about the scene where people get their bodies like mauled and twisted by like magic and stuff? Like, oh, that wasn't so bad. What the portion of people get their eyes peeled out of their sockets? Like, that's not so bad.
It's all good.
It happens.
It's good. It's an oopsie. It happens sometimes, yeah. You know.
It's all good. You know, things happen sometimes. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah, good times.
Yeah, I guess when you're so accustomed to horror, it's just like everything else seems...
Oh, yeah, no, entirely. Like, especially after, like, stuff like Evil Dead. Like, you saw Evil Dead Rise, obviously.
Yes, we talked about it on here, and it was amazing.
Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic. But, like, how many people do you know who saw that, who, you know, their biggest experience with horror is, like, you know, I don't know, The Conjuring. And they came out of that going, wow, that was so violent. I felt so nauseated by that movie. It was so disgusting and brutal. And you walked out going, that's not even the most bloody Evil Dead movie.
How did I go?
What?
You know.
Yeah, you're cutting it out.
Like, am I still there?
Yeah, you're still here. For a second, you were cutting in and out there. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Cool. That's weird. Your phone's acting up? It's in your phone. Can you hear me now?
The 2013.
Hmm. It is I. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me? Yeah, it's strange. I can't hear you right now.
Hold on, give me a second.
Oh, now I can hear you.
Okay. Is it better?
Yeah, now I can hear you. That's good. I'm not sure what happened. That was strange.
Yeah, there's some glitchiness happened. Apologize for that, folks. We were mid conversation when that happened, and I don't really have time to edit, so you're gonna hear all of this.
Fair enough. Okay.
I actually 2013 Evil Dead is more hard to watch than the new one.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Agree with that totally. I would also argue that the grossest scene in the new one was the glass eating scene. That got me.
Oh, that was the worst for you?
Yeah, because the glass is poking out from the inside.
More than the cheese.
Oh, the cheese grater. Whatever. That was fine. It's the glass that gets me. Because I keep thinking all the times I try swallowing things, they're a little too big. And it's like, well, now I can feel that in my throat. It's a pointier. It's just not about that.
Yes. Yeah, it was...
just the worst.
But those people who came out of that movie were disgusted.
Oh god, people were a little intense though in some parts. Like some people, the reaction some people had was a little much. I loved it, but like some people, it just seemed a little too repulsed for comfort.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I feel that affects you. Like if you're a horror fan, like it really distorts your perspective on what normal people think of as violent. I'm not sure it's a good or bad thing.
Yeah, so what I was saying was that Evil Dead Rise to me wasn't nearly as gruesome as 13. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I just think it's a different approach from the perspective of the directors. But I'm very curious what the audience thinks of that. Maybe those who don't normally see these types of movies, you know?
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, I think honestly with Rise... is it was a film that was more accessible, but also just as brutal as, not as brutal, obviously. I think 13 is more brutal, but like 2013 is more brutal. But I think it was indicative of like, the response to it has been great. Like people have loved this film. Like people have been very positive. So it's doing something really right. I think bringing it down to like a more human, intimate level really helped them explore a different angle of the horror. And, I mentioned this in the Dread Central article I wrote regarding the film, but I kind of hope they go into historical periods for the next couple of films. Like, I really hope they go back in time and just show the book in different periods of history. I think there's so much you could do with that, and it's so cool. I don't know.
Did you hear the? We talked spoilers, so we can still talk it. But mm-hmm. Did you hear that Lee Cronin has said that Bruce Campbell's cameo in the movie is Ash.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I think and it's I'm a like, cool.
My headcanon is that it's the Ash from the TV show.
I would love that. I would love that so much.
He would still keep trying to go back in time, but failing.
Yeah, no. I really wish... that's the case. I really hope that becomes canon. I hope they do that canonically. Cause
yeah.
And Bruce Campbell's involved with these films still. Like, he's a producer, obviously. But I feel like what they can do in the future is bring him in, like, a small cameo role. Like, they don't have to have him get beaten up by, like, his hand for, you know, the whole movie. Or get bombarded with blood. Or get thrown off a building.
Or... I mean, he doesn't have to be the punching bag, right?
No,
like,
no.
He could be like the older, like wiser. Not wiser. He's kind of dumb, but
he's never going to be the wise character. If he's the wise character, that totally defeats the purpose of Ash.
He would be the older, slightly more experienced character.
Mm-hmm. I can see
not
that.
Not wiser, but experienced.
I would like to see them like have. Ash, Mia from 2013, and the main character from Rise, I'm drawing a blank on her name, in the same movie, and just have Ash be the most incompetent, but also somehow the most kick-ass character in the group, where he is completely out of his depth in terms of what's happening emotionally or intellectually, but just by sheer dumb luck, he's able to take care of everything.
I think what we like to see, what we call for Ash, is what we like to say is dumb luck. The fact that he is some sort of supernaturally enhanced person. Like, they don't specifically say that he has powers, but yeah. I think his luck is part of his things because he is in the book. I mean, there's a reason.
Yeah.
There's a reason why he's mentioned. Like, I'm not sure. I can't seem to remember. The show never really, like, directly addressed that, right? Like, they didn't, like, give the most hardest of answers when it comes to the fact that I think Ash, despite his own idiocy, is what makes him a compelling character. He is given the role of the protector of the world. Like, he is supernaturally has... something about him. Maybe his luck is his powers, you know, but
I think it's I think it's just kind of fascinating how you go from the first film, and I rewatched all the Evil Dead films before the new one came out. You go from the first film where he's just like this random dude who's just put in this situation that's awful. And two, he becomes almost like this cosmic punching bag who can never be happy, who is always made more miserable by his experiences. And you get the Army of Darkness, where because of the circumstances that put him in the situation, he's the only guy who knows what he's doing, and he's just so done with everything. Like, he just wants to go home and sleep.
And he's also incredibly stupid.
But he can make gunpowder in the medieval era. With, like, a high school chemistry book. Like, that's the thing, he's an idiot, but he's also, like, surprisingly clever when it counts. As the plot
Again, demands. I think that also could be part of the... You could always retroactively explain that as part of the supernatural abilities.
That's true. He his brain cells quintuple whenever it's needed, and then they go back into recession afterwards.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
They recess back into the annals of his gray matter afterwards. as the plot demands, of course.
Yeah, and I do... I still love that.
Oh, it's great.
I still love that in Ash vs. Evil Dead, he's the reason why it all comes back to.
Oh, yeah, completely. He just gets high one day. He's like, hey, look at this. Look how cool this is.
Well, I think the title drop is probably one of the best in the series of him just going, fuck.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. The whole show is great. What are we talking about?
Yeah. See, if you haven't seen Ash vs. Evil Dead, it's hilarious. It is the most gory and slapstick funny of the whole series.
Oh, yeah.
What do you say?
I would say watch it on Netflix, but you can't because they took it off of their broadcast.
I would also say on Amazon, there's a Blu-ray collection that includes 1 and 2 and the whole show. That if I didn't already own a lot of these individually on Blu-ray, I would totally buy.
Exactly.
I forgot what it's called, but... It's a nice collection. It comes with, like, a whole art book. And it's, like, all three of those things, so. The only thing it doesn't have is Army of Darkness because it's Universal.
Yeah. That's just unfortunate.
But the Shout Factory release is great, so.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, thankfully they have a lot of good releases of Army of Darkness.
And, like, 4 different versions of the movie.
But I will say this, because horror exists, getting back to that one topic that before, because horror is so ubiquitous and so grotesque and so ever applicable, whenever you read something dark that people would argue is dark, it's almost fun for us. And I feel like it also means that we grasp on better to works that are like that. So over the top, it's cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the other night, I was going through Amazon Prime looking for... I'll do this on occasion. I'll go through Amazon Prime and just look for a movie that's on there. Or Tubi. That's good for this, too. That looks like it's just absolutely terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Just to look for something that's just, like, absolute nonsense that no one else would watch. And
you mean something that Riff Trax would cover.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Without the Riff Trax. And what I found was... I'm gonna look this up, the name of it, to make sure I get the name of this right, because I think you should all watch this because it's so terrible and so dumb that I have to recommend it. And apparently, it's on multiple streaming services. Wow,
awesome!
Why would they put this on here? It's 1990s Quest for the Mighty Sword.
That's not an easy name.
No. Quest for the Mighty Sword, also known in certain countries as Ator 3, The Hobgoblin. Also known as The Hobgoblin. Also known, and this is the title I knew it under as, Troll 3.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's called Troll 3 because the costumes from Troll 2 are throughout this movie. Like the little goblin costumes. This is in the movie. There's multiple characters who wear this costume.
Well, that's kind of amazing.
I mean, one definitely wears it, and one looks like he wears like a modified version of it, where it's like just the mask and a bigger torso. But it's like, it's just the goblins from Troll 2. And the plot of the movie, if you can call it that, is...
Are you talking about the Nilbog?
Yeah, the Nilbog. It's goblin spelled backwards. Yeah. So what happens is, this is only at 2.7 on IMDb, and I think it deserves all 2.7 of those points. 7% on Rotten Tomatoes. Cowards, I'd say.
They should have rated it. It should have been an Academy Award winner, right?
Yeah, we're talking a Best Picture nom right here.
It's your heart out, Maltese Falcon.
Oh yeah, God, that was ridiculous. This is basically like, I like to think of it like this. There's some stories out there that are what everyone's D&D campaign eventually becomes, and what they wish it was. And usually for this, I'd say like, oh, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, great example of what a D&D campaign ends up becoming. To use an example, I cited earlier in this podcast, Six of Crows, a great example of a story that's basically a D&D campaign.
Hell, even the D&D movie is like...
Oh, especially the D&D movie. But Quest for the Mighty Sword is what people's first D&D campaign turns out to be when they're 12. Like, it is... the hokiest, most incoherent, like, King's sword is split in two pieces by what's either an evil god or a wizard or a Ganon, a guy, you know, or a goblin Ganon. I'm not sure how to even explain this character.
Oh my god, I'm looking up Google Images, and yeah, these are the costumes.
Yeah, it's the exact costume. It's the same fucking thing. And, like, no one in this movie looks like they are... you know, this athletic behemoth who should be able to, like, take on the world. They all just look like guys. They look like people who are just in, who are friends of the directors, and which is good on one hand. I like seeing just average people in movies. That's cool. But none of these people look comfortable in anything they're wearing. They all look very self-conscious, and they all look like they're embarrassed to be there. Like, they know it's goofy.
Like, they probably were.
Yeah, they all look, like, uncomfortable. Like, just no one looks like they're having a good time. They have, like, these dead serious expressions and scenes that are like, you know, Ator, I have to swing the sword of the gods to unleash the gods' justice. Oh, no, here comes the guy. My sword, it's been split in two. Ah, I am dead.
So I'm going to assume you're going to watch the other three movies, right, in the series?
Oh, the Ator films? I've seen Ator 1, actually.
They're Italian films, right?
Yeah, they're all Italian. They're all the Italian knockoff movies. And they're all hokey, but like, what?
They're all that bad?
I would say Ator 1 is bad in that kind of, you can still watch it kind of way.
Oh, so it's like one of those early 80s fantasy films, right?
Yeah, but I wouldn't put it on... because this 80s fantasy, I've been going back to a lot of 80s fantasy. I do that every few years and just watch a bunch of, like, those swords and sorcery kind of movies. And there's some that are actually pretty decent.
You mean like Kroll?
Kroll's one. Obviously the Conan films.
Yeah.
I would say Beastmaster is another one. What was the one? Oh, I'm drawing a blank on it with Rutger Hauer... and Ferris Bueller. Lady Hawk. Yeah, Lady Hawk's pretty good.
Oh, Lady Hawk.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, that one's pretty good.
You know, it's funny, I haven't seen a lot of 80s, like, fantasy. I know of it. I love more 80s horror, but yeah.
Oh, 80s horror is probably is more consistent and usually better. But there's some good 80s fantasy films. But they hit a certain vibe that's very unusual. I wouldn't count Legend in this cycle because Legend feels more fairy tale-ish.
Right.
Same with like Labyrinth, same with Dark Crystal. I feel like they're just legitimately good fantasy films.
I do love Labyrinth and Dark Crystal.
Oh, yeah. But I feel like they're different. Like they don't feel the same way that these films do.
I mean, they're Jim Henson, so.
Oh yeah, but there's something else too. The difference with Labyrinth and Dark Crystal is that they're not trying to be very machismo. Whereas these other films are radiating with the attempt at machismo.
Yeah, that's true.
But everyone in it also feeling incredibly silly while doing it.
Yeah, there's definitely a machismo energy to those ones you're describing. Because, like, I think of Labyrinth and, like, Dark Crystal, and they just feel like people who love fantasy wanting to make fantasy.
Exactly.
Well, Labyrinth feels like queer people wanting to make fantasy.
Yeah. I mean, it's all David Bowie's crotch. The whole, like, it's basically about, I mean, if you really think about Labyrinth on a plot level, it's about a LARPer who accidentally summons goblins to kidnap her baby brother and then realizes, wait, hang on a second, that was a bad idea. And then gets either seduced or flirted with by immortal David Bowie, who, honestly, for him, there's nothing at stake for him. He's just kind of there. Like, he's not, like, nothing bad happens to him, really. He's just, like, playing a game and having a good time with it.
Which is why he's the most interesting part of the movie.
Oh, yeah, because the whole time he's just, like, he's not actually, like, in any danger of losing something. He's just, like, having, like, a fun time with this, which is also creepy because he also has, like, a young girl who he's, like, I'm not sure if that's, like, meant to be as weirdly, like, flirty, but it's, like, really weird, but also kind of fits with that weird adolescent, like, confusion a lot of people had where they're, like, attracted to older celebrities, but then you're like, wait a second, if this older celebrity was just as interested in me as I am to them, that would be really uncomfortable.
Well, that movie's also strange because is he flirting with her?
Yeah, I'm not sure what.
Is he not?
It's really strange because I'm also not sure, like, how much of that is just David Bowie. Like, not the David Bowie, but the Goblin King. Because obviously Bowie's a character, is an actor. He's not actually, a great talented singer. He's not actually, like, he's not the character he's playing. But, like, how much of that is the Goblin King, like, flirting with her or just playing on her innate desires to better manipulate her?
Plus, couldn't this also be seen as, like, a giant metaphor for, like, a teenager, like, sort of coming of age or finding her own responsibility?
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, where the Goblin King is, like, the fantasy of, I don't know, letting things go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because with Labyrinth, since it is an adolescent fantasy series, and yeah. I have been obsessively bringing up Six of Crows this entire conversation as a more modern fantasy series, the comparison of how fantasy written for teenagers and younger audiences and how it's shifted over the years is very interesting. Because back then, it's very much like the teenager is out of their element. They're in a situation where they can't control anything.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the story is about them gaining power.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of fantasy now, the teenagers are on their own. Like, no one cares about them. They're at a disadvantage in life. And all that they have is stuff they've gotten for themselves because they've had to fight for it, the scraps that remain. And
that feels very...
it's telling me something. It's telling me something about how we see how society, how the audiences see themselves and how the writers writing for that audience sees the audience's interests. And it's very telling about how a lot has changed in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
But I find that very interesting when you reflect that. Like, wait a second. One of these is about a powerless person gaining power. The other is about these really skilled people having to succeed in the world that is all against them at a fundamental level.
Yeah.
I find that very interesting. I find that dichotomy very interesting. And of course, I'm speaking in broad trends. Obviously, that's not every fantasy story written in that era or currently, but I do find that an interesting continuum.
You can always find trends in art, though, based on the time period that you're looking at them.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, it's, like, impossible for modern art to not be influenced by society's norms and expectations.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I say that all art is a political entity. It does not mean that it is consciously political, just that, you know, it exists in the political landscape. There's some cog of influence in there somewhere of the world, of society, of how we see ourselves. And I find it very interesting. And you see it especially in horror.
That's true. You're reminding me of something.
Mm-hmm.
As
I do.
With this really interesting talk about fantasy. We were going to switch into, because I think we're getting probably to the, not wrapping up yet, but there was some other point that I wanted to bring up before we start to wrap up, and that was, mm-hmm. You had something you wanted to vent about.
What was it going to vent about? I forgot.
Some book.
Oh, I already have. I haven't needed this whole time.
That's what it was.
Yeah, God, yeah. This book's incredible.
Sorry, my mind was not picking up.
I've been weaving it into the conversation organically, one might say, or just forcing it in there, like the beak of a. I'm not gonna make that joke. It's terrible.
But I appreciate our conversation about Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, because I am kind of a fan of Henson, so I think Henson's work. I don't need to make that movie per se, but like I'd still consider it under his umbrella.
Oh, it's still Henson's work.
Yeah, it's still under Henson's work.
Have you ever seen the? I just watched this again recently because it was recommended to me by the YouTube algorithm. The Muppet sketch in the that was like the memorial service to Jim Henson.
Mm-hmm.
Like how many creative bodies of work? How many of those would have something like that, where they have the characters that the person created reacting to his demise? Like how. And it's emotional, it's heartbreaking, and it is very self-aware, but also still embodies the spirit of the creation. Like I can't think of a single other work that where you'd see something like that happen.
That is a very good question, and I don't know.
Yeah, like I can't think of anything else where I've seen anything remotely like that. And I think it's proof of Henson's, you know, creativity and his genius, but
yeah.
So heartbreaking about that, and like emotional and powerful. I don't know.
I think he would have been. I do think his legacy still stands, and like I personally still think he would have been really proud of the Dark Crystal television show that happened.
I know he definitely would be, and I am so annoyed that got canceled. To this day, I'm not over that. I'm still upset by that.
I'm not over it either, because it was so good.
It was one of those, like, just perfect follow-ups, just from start to finish.
I'm going to say it's better than the original film. Like, the original film gets credit for, like, the amount of, creativity and, like, technical pulling off as it did.
Yeah, I feel that's fair. Like...
It's genuinely an impressive film to watch, but it's more impressive technically than it is in a sort of narrative perspective.
It's a mood piece, really.
I still think there's enough there that's interesting, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great mood piece, The Dark Crystal. I feel like the mood it sets is fantastic, but good luck following that plot. there is a plot you can follow, obviously. I'm not saying there's not, but like, It's not something that you get the first time you watch, because it is kind of so dreamlike and surreal that there are points when you kind of like just get so absorbed into the music and the visuals that you forget what is driving the action.
Right.
And it is so unsettling at times. But
it's really creepy and weird.
Yeah. But I feel like I never had that issue with the Dark Crystal series. Like, it was always like very clear what was happening. I knew where all the characters stood. I knew where their names, their motives, you know, what they were.
Narratively, it's a much better story.
Yeah, it's more cohesive, I would say.
Yeah.
Whereas the Dark Crystal is more of an atmosphere.
Right. And I give the show credit for also being technically impressive. Like, are we ever going to see a dark fantasy show made for adults that's using puppetry? Like that.
Japan has a couple of those. Or China, okay. I forget which country.
I think I should say from like more of like a Western.
Oh, never, never, never. Yeah, that's never going to happen. And also the ones from China and Japan, I don't think they're as good as Dark Crystal was.
Well, Crystal had the benefit of having a pretty good budget.
Like, that also, yeah.
The effects looked great. The puppets looked great. The integration of CGI and other forms of animation into it. were stunning. The voice acting was great too.
Really good cast.
Yeah. Great cast. Like, oh, yeah. A-list actors. And you know,
everyone in it was like, is fantastic. Outside Mark of this
Hamill
brilliant.
And, like, yeah.
Oh, I guess Anya Taylor-Joy. Who else was in this? Let me look up the cast list for this. Just
wasn't Taron Egerton?
Oh, yeah. Let me give you the full cast list here. It was Resistance. You have Mark Hamill, Taron Egerton, Nathalie Emmanuel, Anya Taylor-Joy, Lena Headey, Awkwafina, Keegan-Michael Key, Simon Pegg, Harvey Feinstein, first
year. Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs.
Benedict Wong.
Yeah, Benedict Wong, Toby Jones, Helena Bonham Carter, Eddie Izzard, who's what is her name now? I know she just Mark Strong, Natalie Dormer.
Yeah, just stacked. Yeah.
Massively, massively. Oh, Bill Hader was in this.
Huh.
You know that Bill Hader was BB-8?
Yes.
I didn't realize that until someone told me that recently. Like, I've watched Star Wars, the sequel trilogy a few times now, and I like, always did not realize that was Bill Hader this whole time. I was like, oh, wow, that blew my mind.
Oh, the narrator was Sigourney Weaver. I forgot about that.
Oh, so. Yeah. Freaking, of course. Also, I will say this also. I just started watching Avatar 2. I watched like the first half of it and took a break. One, better than the first film, I feel, because I don't like the first one all that much. But two, it's really weird hearing Sigourney Weaver's voice coming out of a teenage character.
Yeah.
Like, it's really weird and off-putting, and I don't like it. It makes me uncomfortable.
It definitely doesn't sync up.
Right? No, it's really strange. And
not that she's giving a bad performance. It's just
no, she's fine. She's good in the role. I will say this. I appreciate how Avatar 2 is just so bonkers that it's kind of fun. Like, it's so ridiculous that I'm like, yeah, this is good. I'm enjoying this.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I don't love it. I'm not a huge...
No, no.
James Cameron's world hasn't, like, impressed me yet, but...
No, but the world's impressed me. My problem is the characters, you know? And the plot. None of it, like, link. I don't feel any empathy with it. He's so caught up with showing off this beautiful world that he forgets...
To, like...
To yeah, it's a narrative.
Yeah,
it's a narrative, ultimately. It's not a... I'm not here for your D&D source book. I'm here to watch a movie.
I think we were talking about this. The original Dark Crystal kind of has something sort of similar in that regard. But I will say, I like the mood of Dark Crystal more, you know?
Yeah, Dark Crystal has a great mood. Like, there's such a great atmosphere. And that's the thing also. Like, Dark Crystal's world isn't as well-developed as Avatar. But, like... I could tell you everything about it because I just care more.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I just care about that world more because it's so unusual and haunting and unsettling.
That's true. It's so unsettling. The show even. Yeah, we're just going to have, like, some of the scariest moments.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just traumatize your children for you. For life. Yeah. Just now. Casually.
There are some very traumatizing moments in that.
Oh, the Skeksis decaying, really, that got me a lot as a kid. That freaked me out so much.
Yeah.
That it just, like, crumbles to dust. That was a bit too much. And in hindsight, I'll tell you why I like it so much. What?
Even the show, they had that weird quicksand.
Oh, yeah. That? Yeah, that was weird. There was a lot of weird stuff in that show. There was some weird stuff in that.
Which I think if kids saw that, they would be, like, horrified.
Yeah, but I feel also, like, you know, I feel also, like, with kids now, they have so many other traumatizing media that they could watch, too, that gets them ready for that.
News?
Even what?
I said, you said traumatizing things, and I said the news.
Yeah, actually, it's a good point. That's actually very true. I remember one of my earliest memories was the O.J. Simpson trials. I remember that being a big... thing. And I just remember that distinctly. Oh, yeah, the O.J. Simpson trials are going on. And just knowing about that.
For sure. Actually, you know, at this point, I think we've reached a good point of the conversation. I would keep going, but I actually should be wrapping up this episode.
Indeed. I could talk for hours with you. You know that.
Same. Yeah. Well, would you like to plug where people can find you?
Yes. You can find me on the Twitter and TikToks. On Twitter, I am AGRAMUGLIA. On TikTok, which I have been doing more and more of because I am obnoxious and need the attention, I am under the just my full name, Anthony Grumulia. That is AnthonyGrumulia. I have articles in a few different places, including one article I'm working on for Anime Feminist right now, another article I'm working on right now for Dread Central. I have articles in CBR, Screen Rant, Polygon, Anime, Herald, a few different places. The Mary Sue, Polygon, did I say Polygon? Yeah, I have an article there. Yeah. Maybe a couple places. But mainly you can find me on Twitter and TikTok.
Go support them. It's great.
Yeah, I am very obnoxious and I will not waste your time too much. Not too much, actually.
Wonderful. And you can follow me on, I'm Crystal Williams. You can find my Medium account. But I'm also on Twitter most of the time. You can at me at Crystal W Rocks. And then in my bio on Twitter, I got a link tree that you can click to any of the places that you like and support me. So yeah, that's all we got. So thank you for being on this episode again.
It's my pleasure. Yeah, I'm always happy to talk to you.
Yeah, have conversations, especially about Metal Gear, Henson, and old 80s fantasy adventure stories.
Indeed. And finding ways to shove the whatever book I'm reading right now into the conversation very smoothly, I might add.
Well, this is a geeky show, so it's always welcome. But thank you, and thank you for everyone listening. We will be on the next episode. And we hope to see you next time. Goodbye, everybody.